If we don't catch him, he'll carve them all up in the same twisted way.
Well, that's not happening, said Captain Roloff Antonius Quintus, my boss, who was coming toward me with other members of the task force. If that Jane Doe turns out to be Bree, he's killed a D.C. cop. At the very least, he's kidnapped a D.C. cop's family. For that, he will pay.
The rest of the detectives and FBI agents behind him nodded grimly. Thank you, Captain, I said, nodding to the others. Thank you all for everything you're doing. I got out the envelope I'd taken from Dawson's office. I went to Sojourner Truth and found the principal back from vacation, I told them. I have a business card Mulch gave her when he went there to speak to the kids. I handed it over to the captain, explaining about the fake website that was almost like the one a real Thierry Mulch ran. Everything was the same except the picture of Mulch. It took sophisticated computer work, the kind Preston Elliott could do in his sleep. Quintus, Sampson, and Mahoney exchanged glances.
Why don't you sit down, Alex? The captain said.
What's going on?
Quintus took a deep breath and pointed to a chair.
Reluctantly, I sat in it, and I felt my eyes begin to burn even before Ned Mahoney spoke.
3 days ago, the Fairfax County Sheriff was called to a commercial pig farm in Berryville, Virginia, Mahoney began. The owner found a human skull and a piece of femur in some machinery. Quantico ran the DNA and got 3 immediate matches.
I squinted at the light in the room, which suddenly felt too strong.
3?
Sampson said, semen taken from that rape scene in Alexandria. Semen taken from the pants leg of Mandy Bell Lee's murdered attorney, and the hair sample Preston Elliott's mother filed as part of his missing persons report. It took several moments before I grasped the implications of all that. 10 days before, the attorney of country western star Mandy Bell Lee had been found poisoned in his room at the Mandarin Oriental. That same night, a man who called himself Thierry Mulch had raped a woman in Alexandria. Since we had clear DNA evidence linking the rape and the murder to Preston Elliott, we had been working under the assumption that the missing computer engineering student and Mulch were one and the same. But Mulch was not Elliott. He could not be Elliott because the DNA match on the bones found at the pigsty was dead certain, which meant Mulch killed Elliott and dumped his body in that pig barn, I said.
We think so, Sampson said, nodding. Pigs will eat anything you throw at them.
I remembered something Ali had told me about Mulch. It fits. When Mulch spoke at Ali's school, he said that he'd grown up on a pig farm.
So how do we think this worked? Captain Quintus asked. Mulch got Elliot's sperm before he killed him?
Why not? Sampson replied. It's a brilliant way for Mulch to throw us, isn't it? Plant a dead man's DNA at a rape scene and at a murder.
This son of a bitch is diabolical, Mahoney said.
You're right, I said. Mulch is diabolical. He's very smart, thinks long-term, and is cruel and audacious, which strikes me as narcissistically evil.
Captain Quintus nodded. Believes in himself above all others, thinks he's too smart to get caught.
Which means he's gotten away with serious shit before, Sampson said. It's mutually reinforcing with these guys.
Mahoney said, what I'd like to know is Mulch acting solo? Or are there others involved in what he's doing?
Chapter 12. Could Mulch have kidnapped my entire family in less than 10 hours, starting with Damon at his prep school in the Berkshires on his own? On Good Friday morning,
Damon was supposed to have taken a 7:45 jitney from campus to the Albany train station. But according to the driver, at the last minute, Damon told a friend that he was canceling because he'd gotten a ride to Washington. But with whom? Mulch? Or someone else? We hadn't been able to answer those questions because the craft school, like Sojourner Truth, had been closed for vacation. In any case, I knew from personal experience that the drive from the craft school to D.C. takes at least 7 hours, and Good Friday traffic had to have been thick. So let's say 8 hours. That put Mulch in Washington around 4. Bree, Ali, Janny, and Nana Mama were all taken in the following 2 hours. Theoretically, then, it was possible that Mulch had done this alone. But if so, he'd acted with what felt like pinpoint and ruthless precision. "My instincts say he had help," I said. "The sperm found at the rape and the murder scene supports that, too." "How's that?" Mahoney asked. "Unless Elliot was a homosexual, it makes sense to me that Mulch had a female accomplice. She lured the kid in for sex, saved his sperm, probably from a condom, and Mulch killed him afterward." "It fits," Quintus said. It did fit. As if a fog bank were lifting, we were beginning to get a clearer view of the world behind us, a world I would have given my soul to return to. I said, "Can someone go back to George Mason, back to Elliot's friends? Ask them about any women he might have been seeing." "I'll do it myself," Mahoney promised. I looked at Samson. "Feel like driving?"
"Where are we going?"
"That farm where they found Elliot's bones." "Ah," Captain Quintus began, sharing a glance with Mahoney. "You sure you want to be working now, Alex?" My breath turned shallow. "I can't just sit here and wait for more members of my family to show up dead, Cap. I refuse to. That's what Mulch wants, and I just won't do it."
"Alex," Mahoney said, "maybe..."
I glared at my old friend, said, "If I don't work, Ned, I'll be lost to Bree, and I won't be lost to her. Not now." Mahoney nodded slowly, and then gestured at Samson and said, "But you're driving, John. With that head injury, he's still in no condition to be behind the wheel." Chapter 13. It took Samson and me about an hour to get free of D.C. traffic and take blue highways out through Reston and McLean and on into the rural land you find the more west and south you go in Virginia. We rode most of the way in silence, but Samson's pity and grief were as clear as if he'd spoken words of condolence or shock. Samson's mere presence, the living, breathing embodiment of my longest relationship in life other than Nana Mama, was the only reason I didn't completely crack up during the drive to the pig farm. But no matter how I tried to stop it, I kept flashing on images of Bree during our courtship. That first shared, bashful smile. The first time I touched her fingers. The first time her lips met mine. How much she liked to dance and laugh. How committed she was to being a cop and a stepmother to my kids.
"You thinking about her, Shug?"
Samson asked. There were times when I could swear my partner was clairvoyant, or at least he picked up on subtle changes in my body so perfectly that he could decipher my thoughts. Or it was an easy guess. I don't know. "Yeah," I said, and fell quiet again for several long moments, swallowing hard at unbridled emotion. "John,
talk to me,"
he said. "I don't know how to," I began, and then faltered. "I can't..."
"Can't what?"
"Think of Bree as gone," I said through clenched teeth.
It's like my heart can't believe it. I didn't even get to say goodbye. I wasn't there to tell her how much I loved her, how she made everything in my life so whole, Samson said softly. Anchored, I replied. It was the perfect word for what Bree had done in my life. She was the person who anchored me, grounded me, kept me from washing away.
We don't have DNA results yet, Samson said.
I've been telling myself that.
And you keep telling yourself that, you hear?
It started to rain. Samson turned on the wipers, and the slapping sounded like nails being pounded by one of those air guns. I closed my eyes, reached up, and started rubbing at that spot on the back of my head where the junkie had hit me with a piece of pipe.
Headaches still as bad? Samson asked.
Getting better, I said, though that was an overstatement.
You need to get that checked out again, Alex, Samson said. It's been like 6 days and you're still hurting. You should see a neurologist.
Doctor said to expect the headaches, I said. Part of the healing process. They could go on for months. And right now, I don't need another doctor to tell me the same thing. My partner looked ready to argue, but then he spotted a sign ahead in the light rain that read, Pritchard's Farm, Specialty Pork.
There it be,
he said, slowing and turning. We drove up a long dirt driveway bordered on both sides by trees that looked brilliantly green, all wet and new. It was spring, a time of rebirth, but it felt like November to me when we rolled into an orderly farmyard that reeked of a stench I can't even begin to describe. As we climbed from the car, we heard a squealing din coming from a huge, low-roofed building that sat on a bench of earth about a quarter mile from a picture-perfect farmhouse that looked recently built.
Pork belly's been good to someone, Samson observed.
A weathered woman in her 40s wearing a green rain jacket, rubber gloves, and calf-high rubber boots over her jeans came around the side of the house. She carried a pitchfork and revealed smears of soil on her right cheek when she pushed off her hood and brushed back graying hair to look at us. Samson already had his badge out.
Mrs. Pritchard,
you hear about the skull and the bone? She asked.
We are, I said.
Expect you better talk to Royal about that, my husband, she said, gesturing up the hill with the pitchfork. He's on up to the barn. It's feeding time. That's the reason he found them bones. Feeding time. But I expect he'll be wanting to tell you that himself.
Chapter 14. We found Royal Pritchard out on one of several catwalks that crossed above the industrial pigsty. There were thousands of young pigs, or shoats, jammed into a pit that was easily a football field long and a quarter again as wide. A short, stocky guy in muddy rubber boots and Carhartt work clothes. Pritchard had a lit cigar in his mouth as he worked a set of hydraulic controls bolted to the railing of the catwalk. Responding to the pig farmer's manipulations, a long line of feeders crossed above the sty from left to right, dropping corn in a steady, drenching stream. The pigs were going berserk in response, all trying to follow the rain of food, squealing and grunting so loud that it changed the pounding in my head, made it like the inside of a bell that was tolling. Samson got Pritchard's attention, and the farmer shut down the feeding system, which sent the pigs into a howling, squealing rage that seemed to join with the gonging in my head, speeding it, amplifying it, until I just couldn't take being in there any longer, and I ran blindly for the door. 5 seconds later, I burst out of the pigsty and ran on out toward the tree line in the rain, trying to control the excruciating pain that crackled from the base of my skull up. But the pain wouldn't stop, and I felt my stomach roll and thought I might be violently sick. By the time Samson came out with the pig farmer 10 minutes later, however, the rain had cooled me down. My stomach was feeling better, and the ringing in my head had softened to a distant pealing.
"That smell takes some getting used to, even with a cigar to mask it,"
Pritchard allowed, looking sympathetic.
"No doubt about that. But I don't mind, you know. That's the smell of money in there, sure as I'm standing right here."
"Pork futures are up, huh?" Samson asked.
"It's the new white meat, ain't you heard?"
Pritchard replied.
"Price of fatted shoats has doubled past 3 years."
"You found the skull and a bone?" I asked. The farmer nodded.
"I showed your partner where. Wasn't too far from where you was standing when you got to feeling kind of, well, piggish, what I call it."
"Tell him how you found the skull," Samson said.
Pritchard shrugged.
"One of them things. The hopper jammed out in the middle, and the corn was just pouring there, and every pig in the place wanted to be at the center. Anyway, I opened up the sides enough I could see the skull and bone there, plain as day, in the dung. Fished the skull out with a hook duct taped to a pole. Sheriff's deputies used a claw thing to get the bone.
Nothing else? No other bones?" Pritchard's cheek twitched.
"Not that I seen. But hell, there's 3, maybe 4 inches of shit in there front to back. You're welcome to come rake through it after the gold on the hoof's up to weight and off."
"How long will that be?" I asked.
20 days.
I have never been the sort of man who flies off the handle, but for some reason I thought about the possibility there were other bones in that pigsty, and I just lost it.
"We're not waiting fucking 20 days,
I shouted at him.
"The fucker who dumped the body in there killed my goddamned wife. I'm getting a warrant, and I'm getting those goddamn pigs out of there today."
"Christ, detective," Pritchard said, looking offended.
"I'm sorry about your wife. Jesus knows I am. But you're acting like I tossed a body in there."
"Did you?"
I demanded.
Pritchard said, "Oh, hell no! What the—"
I had 7 inches and 50 pounds on the farmer. When I popped him in the chest with my right hand, he staggered backward and sat down hard in the gravel, shocked.
"You know a guy named Mulch?" I demanded. "He related to you?"
"Alex,"
Samson said. I ignored him.
"Is he?"
The farmer acted scared as he complained.
"Yeah, I don't know no one named Mulch. No, sir, and that's a fact."
"Mulch was raised on a pig farm," I replied angrily. "He came here specifically to get rid of that body. Mulch has to know you."
"No, sir,"
Pritchard repeated flatly.
"Never even heard of that name. Go down and ask my wife. Ellie and I have been together since high school, and she'll tell you the same."
He looked at Samson.
"I called the sheriff second I fished out that skull. I could have just left it, and it'd be fragments in the pig shit by now. Think on that."
It all went out of me then, and I realized what I'd done. My shoulders sank, and I squatted down next to him, shaking my head before I said softly, "Mr. Pritchard, I was way out of line there. I apologize. My wife—" There was a moment of silence before he said quietly, "I understand, detective. When my mom died, I wandered around in a haze for days." I reached out my hand and helped him up. "Again, I'm sorry. I honestly don't know what came over me." Samson put his hand on my shoulder, said,
think we better leave Mr. Pritchard to his chores.
I nodded, apologized a third time, and then walked away from the pig farmer, unwilling to look at the barn anymore, unable to block out the sounds of the ongoing riot inside. Part 2.
Chapter 15. At 4:12 that afternoon, actually 3:12 local time, Mitch Cochran downshifted the Kenworth T680 tractor trailer pulling an empty container chassis into the CSX rail yard in East St. Louis. Sitting between Marcus Sunday and Cochran in the truck cab, Acadia LaDuke said, "Jesus, we're cutting this close. I told you and Dr. Fursing told you we didn't want to get anywhere near the outside limit, and we're pushing right on it." "Have faith, darling," Sunday said calmly. They were supposed to have landed in St. Louis an hour ago, but thunderstorms delayed them, and it had taken a while to get through the paperwork at the truck rental service. "All I'm saying is if we have a catastrophe on our hands, I won't take responsibility," Acadia said. "If it is a catastrophe, we'll call it an act of God and be on our way," Sunday said indifferently. After expertly driving the tractor-trailer rig onto the scales, Cochran jumped out and went inside a steel office building with the necessary lading documents. 10 minutes passed. Then 15. "We're not going to pull this off," Acadia said, frustrated. "We are..." Cochran came running out of the building, climbed up into the cab, said, "They were backlogged." "Jesus," Acadia said, wiping its sweat on her brow. "Calm down," Sunday said as the truck began to roll forward. "We've got a half hour." "You don't get it," she snapped. "It may be over already." "If it is, it is," Sunday said. "And we'll have a cleanup job to do." Cochran drove into a long, wide gravel parking lot that abutted the rail lines. He maneuvered the rig to a gantry crane next to the tracks, stopped, and set the brakes. Cables whirled, swinging giant electromagnets above the rust-red container fitted with the solar panels. The four magnets lowered. A worker positioned them. There was a loud clanking noise as they locked to the sides of the car, and then the cables began to retract. The 45-foot container lifted off the rail car as if it were no heavier than a box of Kleenex. The crane operator expertly swung the container and set it on the chassis behind them. "We have 22 minutes, Acadia said. The magnets released, and Cochran started the engine, put it in gear, and said, "Where to?" "Get back on the interstate, go east to that truck stop we saw coming in." "That'll take too long," Acadia said. Sunday said nothing. Cochran maneuvered through the city streets by GPS and had them back on the I-70 heading east in 9 minutes. When they had 12 minutes left, he got off at State Highway 203 and turned north into the Gateway Truck Plaza. Cochran pulled over out back by a field of weeds. "Move," Acadia said, holding a large duffel bag she'd retrieved from the sleeping compartment behind them. Sunday jumped down, stepped around the diesel tank, and got up on the fifth wheel frame between the cab and the container. He put a key in the lock of the custom hatch on the front end of the freight car. It wouldn't turn. Had that kid in the rail yard back in Philly bent the hasp? He tried again, then jiggled the lock and twisted a third time. He thought the key was going to break off in the lock. Then something gave, and the hasp released. He pulled it out, raised the bar holding the hatch shut. It swung open. 10 minutes, Acadia said, handing him the duffel. "I'm putting my money on you," Sunday said, and ducked into the pitch-black space. Acadia glanced up at the leaden sky before following him and shutting the door behind her. Chapter 16. When the hatch opened 20 minutes later, they were both drenched with sweat. Acadia came out first, carrying the duffel, which was considerably lighter. Sunday had a large black plastic trash bag in his hands. "Told you we were good," he said. Acadia got down off the frame, wiped at the sweat on her face, said, "It was touch and go there, I'm telling you." "What you're trained for," he said, setting the bag down and turning to close and lock the hatch. "I left the field because I hated stuff like that, still do. Sometimes we have to just push through the nasty tasks in life." "That qualified," she said, and went back to the truck cab. Sunday dug out a small plastic box filled with silicone earplugs. He mashed a chunk of one into the key slot so he'd know if it had been tampered with, and then got down. Cochran had the engine going by the time he shut the door. Sunday looked at the driver. "Any visitors?" "Couple of pickups went by," Cochran said, putting the truck in gear and pulling out. "Nothing to worry about." Acadia said, "It's 5:22, well, 4:22 here. We've got until Monday morning, same time." "Gotta be at the dock by 6, Cochran grunted. Sunday looked at Google Maps, said, "Piece of cake." After they'd gotten onto I-70, heading west this time, toward the Mississippi River, Acadia said, "Why are we doing all this, Marcus? I mean, really. Deep down, is this just payback for cross-savaging your book?" Sunday looked at her sidelong for several seconds before flipping his hand dismissively. "If it was just that, I wouldn't have bothered. I am proving to Dr. Alex that I was correct, and he was wrong. But mostly, Acadia, I'm doing it because I can. And because this little project and the logistics involved intrigues and amuses me a great deal." "Does it continue to amuse you?" He delivered the question in a hard voice. Acadia hesitated. But Cochran chortled in the driver's seat, said, "I can tell you it's kicking my ass, Marcus. Most fun I've had since Iraq by a long shot." "Acadia?" Sunday asked, watching her closely. Acadia seemed to struggle before she shrugged in resignation. "Ma always called me a shooting star, born to burn bright and brief." Sunday smiled, reached over and stroked her cheek. "The hell with a shooting star, am I right? Why not ride a comet?" Chapter 17. Acadia was growing increasingly uneasy about everything Sunday had gotten her into. But she said, "A comet sounds good, too." Rush hour traffic slowed them, but within 60 minutes they were pulling onto the scales at the new AEP River Terminal north of the city on the Missouri side. The woman working the scales said, "She's just 1,500 pounds? She's riding empty while we test our experimental solar refrigeration and heating system," Cochran said. "How fast will it go downriver?" "You'd be surprised. With the current up like it is, it's 2.5 days to Memphis, maybe less. 5 days to New Orleans, maybe less. Double that coming upriver. We'd like to be able to inspect the container at Memphis and then again at New Orleans. Long as you're there with the right papers, it shouldn't be a problem." "Can you make us copies?" Cochran said. "I'm always losing stuff." "I can give you 2. "Thanks. What do we owe you then?" Cochran asked. "Loading fees $150. You'll pay the full freight at New Orleans." Cochran handed her cash. She gave him the receipt and lading documents, said, "Pull on ahead. You'll see the dock on your right." "Gantry?" he asked. "New gantries aren't up yet. They'll be using the boom crane." They drove to one of the freight docks on the bank of the river and pulled close to the Pandora, a container barge with a 3-story white and blue wheelhouse at the rear. Cochran showed the crane operator and the barge captain the necessary documents. Cochran, Sunday, and Acadia watched as wide straps were run beneath the container and then hooked to the cable. The crane whirred, The container car rose, swung several times, and then was settled on the deck forward of the other 50 containers already stacked aboard. There was a lot of movement, Acadia said worriedly. Everything inside is strapped down or bracketed in place, Sunday reminded her before calling over to the captain. We'll see you in Memphis to make an inspection. Scotty Creel, a hearty man in his early 50s, nodded, said, Just have that paperwork with you, and you'll have no problems getting through the gates. We'll be tied up there 3-4 hours Monday morning. Back in the Kenworth, Cochran drove them south toward St. Louis, said, We've got plenty of time before the flight. Let's get something to eat. Ribs? Gotta be good here. Sunday turned up his nose. Acadia said, Marcus doesn't do pork. Oh, that's right, sorry, Cochran said. Steak? That'll do, Sunday said. And Cross? Acadia asked. Sunday glanced again at his watch. He said, Mr. Harrow needs time to finish his business. I'll wait until just before our flight leaves to have my first chat with Dr. Alex.
Chapter 18. I woke up around 8:30 that Friday evening, lying on the couch in my darkened office, my rain jacket over my shoulders, and my muddy shoes on the floor beside me. The headache that had tortured me the past 6 days had calmed somewhat. Good nap. Maybe that's all I needed, I thought, before I fully awoke into the living nightmare again. If that was Bree's body, what was I going to do with it? She'd wanted to be cremated and have her remains spread in the Shenandoah, somewhere near the river, where she'd spent the summers of her childhood. I owed her that. Captain Quintus flipped on the light, and I blinked and shielded my eyes. Alex, why don't you come on upstairs? What's going on? I just wanted to talk some things through with you. I got time for a shower. I haven't had one in... go ahead, my boss said. Then he slapped the door jamb and walked away. I felt better after the shower and a change of shirt from my locker, more alert than I had been in days. When I reached the third floor, the demolition team was long gone and the floor had been swept clean. I went through the plastic sheeting and saw 5 people standing near that island of desks under the fluorescent lights. Samson looked like he had something left over from the pig farm on his shoe. I was about to tell him I had the same problem when I noticed Mahoney stirring a dark cup of coffee. Captain Quintus was drinking water, and Aaron Wallace, the D.C. police chief, appeared saddened. Detective Tess Alia was the only one who gave me a steady gaze. She swallowed, said, I wanted to tell you myself. Questions exploded through my brain. Had they found mulch? Had another member of my family turned up? Was I going to have to be tortured again? Go to a dump scene to identify someone I loved? In the end, it was something even more unimaginable and cruel. The autopsy, Alia said. I was there, and... Her eyes were watering, and she shook her head. What? I demanded. We still don't have DNA, but the blood types match, she said. And there's... Samson cleared his throat, said. She was pregnant, Alex. 6 weeks. Hearing about the blood type had made the grief real. Hearing about the baby was too much. My head spun, and I felt sicker than at the pig farm. I sat down hard in one of the chairs, put my face in my hands, the headache pounding with every bit of its earlier fury. I'm sorry, Alia said. Had you been trying? I shook my head bitterly. Said, this is a miracle and a tragedy at the same time. Can you believe that? Shug? Samson said. A great part of me wanted to rail at the sky and the moon, curse God, and demand to know why I'd been singled out for this kind of punishment. Instead, I gazed around at all of them and said, Bree had uterine fibroids about 5 years ago. They removed them, but the procedure left scars. The doctors told us she'd likely never have children. A 1 in 1,000 chance they... I don't think I've ever felt more bewildered in my life than I was at that moment. I didn't even hear Chief Wallace come over beside me, but I felt his heavy hand on my shoulder before he said, Hell of a thing you're going through, Alex. Hell of a thing. Too much for one man to handle. I nodded, cleared my throat, and in a voice tight with emotion said, Chief, it's beyond anything I've ever had to deal with before. He patted my shoulder again. I can't imagine the stress. I'm still standing. The chief took a chair, set it opposite me, and sat down on it, his forearms resting on his thighs and his face twisted in anguish. I know you're still standing. I know you're a fighter, and I know this is personal. That's what makes what I'm going to say now so hard. I'd been nodding, but now I knitted my brow. Chief? Alex, for your own good, and because I respect you so much, I'm placing you on medical leave. That made no sense. What? For the time being, I want you to take a break from this investigation. Let us work on your behalf for once. I'm sorry, Alex, but I need your gun and badge. For a moment, even those words didn't penetrate, but then they did, and it felt like I was being tossed overboard. Chief, you can't do that, I pleaded. I'm good. I'm handling this. No one in your situation could be good, Wallace said. You showed up at your kid's school crying, and then you ranted at the principal. You mistreated a cooperative witness this afternoon. Hit him, as I understand it. I looked at Samson, not believing what was being said, and whispered, You can't do this. I have to find... Captain Quintus shook his head, said, Alex, we're all afraid that the injury to your head and the pressure of all that's happened to you is too enormous to be dealt with while trying to work. We want you to go to a hospital to meet with a neurologist who's waiting to do a baseline. That's not happening, I said. Not now. Alex, Ned Mahoney began. You think I asked for this? I demanded, feeling the heat rise in my face. Who asks for his family to be taken? Who asks for his wife to be cut to pieces? Who asks to be pounded and pounded and... Only then did I realize I'd been shouting at them. They say that's part of it, Shug, Samson said. The anger, coming from the concussion as much as from mulch. You need help. You see that, don't you? Of course he does, John. Mahoney said. He knows the statistics. Gun and badge, detective, the chief said sadly, holding out his hand. Chapter 19. The fight went out of me then, like a liquid draining from my core in a matter of seconds. I handed my badge and gun to Chief Wallace, said, Appreciate your concern. We'll get these back to you as soon as the doctors say it's okay, Wallace reassured me. You're an incredible asset to this department, and we know it. I nodded, stood, went to my desk, and picked up a framed picture of my family and some mail. But I also managed to palm something valuable from the back of my department-issue laptop. With the photograph in my right hand and the mail and flash drive in my jacket pocket, I headed for the plastic sheeting. Samson and Mahoney fell in on either side of me. I'm not going to tip over, you know. I said as we went back through that demolition site. Just making sure you go to the GWU hospital, Sampson said.
See the neurologist, Mahoney added.
I shrugged, said, you're right. We rode the elevator in silence. Sampson and I got out on one. Mahoney went to the basement to retrieve his car. Can I take a leak without you peeking over my shoulder? I asked. My partner thought about it, said, I wouldn't put that duty on my worst enemy. I managed a laugh, and then walked around the corner and into a hallway that ran back toward the crime lab. I pushed the door to the men's room open loudly, kicked off my shoes, picked them up, and jogged down the hall in my socks, taking several turns before the staircase that led to the parking garage. I opened the basement door in time to see Mahoney's taillights as he went up the exit ramp. Pete Kozlowski, a sergeant and head of the motor pool, was an old friend. When I told him I needed a ride, he flipped me the keys to an unmarked car. They were right, I thought as I climbed into the car. I probably did need to see a neurologist, but that would mean at least an overnight stay for observation, maybe two or three. I didn't have that much time to waste. Whatever was going on inside my head was going to have to wait. My phone started ringing 2 minutes later. Sampson called, and then Mahoney. I kept clicking the ringer off and headed for the house. I was going to need a few things. As I drove, out of the corner of my eye, I saw the phone screen lighting up every few seconds. It lit up again while I was idling at a red light on New York Avenue, and I reached over to shut the phone off altogether. Then I saw the caller ID. It said, Mulch. When I answered, I heard shallow, raspy breathing, as if someone were trembling with excitement, and then an electronically altered voice said,
So good of you to take my call, Dr. Cross.
Chapter 20.
Do you understand?
Mulch asked 2 minutes later. Each and every word of my first direct conversation with the man who'd taken my family and butchered my wife was seared on my injured brain, and I couldn't reply.
Do you understand what you need to do to see the surviving members of your family alive again?
Mulch asked insistently. I couldn't answer him. My mind kept flashing on vague images from some movie I'd seen where each of a man's four limbs was tied to a different horse, all of them facing in different directions.
Cross?
I can't.
Too late,
Mulch said, sounding cold and hard through the static that camouflaged his voice.
Another one bites the dust. Look in your backyard, and then call me back.
The static and connection died. I stared at the phone, and then dug out a blue light from the glove box, opened the window, and stuck it on the roof. Shaking from head to toe, I flipped on the siren and floored the accelerator. 6 minutes later, I flipped off the siren, pulled the blue light, and turned onto my block. With every inch I drove, my fear and sorrow grew. Please, God, no, I whispered again and again. But the closer I got to my home, the more I understood that the time for God had passed. There was someone, one of my children, or my grandmother, dead in my backyard. Mulch had done it once. He'd do it twice. I no longer had any doubt of it. I skidded to a stop in front of my home, took a flashlight, and circled to the narrow walkway that led around the side of the house to the backyard. Playing the beam about, I saw the foundation, the plywood walls of the addition, and the portable tool shed and toilet the contractors had brought in. Where the rear fence of my yard met the gate that led out to the alley, My light found the body, and I was hit with the second shockwave of the day, a blow that felt supernatural in its strength and pure evil in its intent. But I didn't go down to my knees as I had earlier. I stood there, seeing Damon's class ring on his right hand, the chain and the St. Christopher's medal around his neck, and the stud and tiny loop earrings in his right ear. He lay on the ground, his lower body twisted toward the wall, his torso and head turned to the night sky. His face had been battered beyond all recognition, and across his entire body, front and back, oval discs of skin were missing every 4 or 5 inches or so, as if mulch had been trying to simulate a leopard's spotted pelt. I tried to tell myself that it might not be my son, but 1,000 memories of Damon spun tragically around me. The air rang with a chorus of his voices, as a giggling toddler who'd love to suck his thumb and curl up in my lap while his mom made breakfast on Saturday mornings. As a troubled 5-year-old trying to understand why his mother had died. As a joyous, victorious 10-year-old after he'd almost single-handedly won a basketball game. As a young man who loved to laugh. Damon had a beautiful laugh that came up out of his belly and seized his whole body. It was genuine and contagious, and one of the things I most loved about him. Right then and there, I knew that I was doomed to pine for that laugh every day for the rest of my life. I wanted to cross the yard and take my firstborn in my arms, feel the weight of the man he'd become. But I didn't. I couldn't. With every passing moment looking at the corpse, I became aware that I'd been changed that day, irrevocably transformed into someone I no longer recognized. Up until mulch, I'd always considered myself a moral man, guided by principles. There were certain lines I'd never cross or even contemplate crossing. But as I gazed at the desecration of my son, I knew that all my principles had been sacrificed and all rules of conduct destroyed. This is not happening again, I vowed to my son before turning away. I promise you that. Flipping off the flashlight, I felt myself swell with righteous anger and went fast around the side of the house, only to pull up short, startled by the silhouette of someone standing there ahead of me. Chapter 21. Alex, Ava said in a fearful voice, is that you? In the long frenzy of the day, I'd completely forgotten about the runaway girl who'd saved my life and my sanity in so many ways. When had she left the house? Last night? I honestly didn't know. Alex? She said, her voice higher. It's me, Ava. She ran to me, hugged me, sobbing. Is it true? Bree? I held her to me, unable to tell her that Damon was in the backyard. It looks that way, I said. Why? She asked. I don't know, I said, pushing her back gently. I have to leave now, Ava.
Why? Where are you going?
To find mulch. I kissed her on the cheek and started toward the house. Ava hurried behind me, saying,
I'm going with you.
No, you are not, I said.
Please, Alex, she begged. I can help you find them. I showed you how the pictures were faked. I can help. I'm good at that kind of stuff.
It was a bad idea to bring Ava with me for too many reasons to count. But she was gifted with computers and damn street smart. She'd shown me that again and again.
I thought about what Mulch wanted me to do to save the rest of my family, and I saw in an instant how it might work. You have a driver's license?
No, but I can drive. My mom's last shitty boyfriend taught me.
Can you listen? Follow orders?
Ava's chin retreated several inches, but she nodded.
I owe you and Nana Mama.
I dug in my pocket, came up with my house key, and opened the door.
Go find Janny's laptop. It's in her room.
Where are we going?
I'm not sure yet, I admitted. Just get the computer. While she went upstairs to look for the computer, I got a bag of clothes and my backup weapon, an old .45 caliber Colt 1911. The pistol was bigger and heavier than the 9mm Glock I had turned over to Quintus, but it had excellent balance, and I shot it well. At short range, with the 230-grain bullets and the hot loads, it could drop a charging rhino in its tracks.
I've got it,
Ava said, looking at the gun as I tugged on a jacket. Good, I said. Let's go.
Do I need one of those?
Ava asked.
One of what?
A gun.
At first, I dismissed it out of hand. Bringing her along was bad enough. Arming her was crazy. But I asked, you ever shot a gun? She shook her head.
Seen it on TV?
Little bit different in reality, I said. But I went into Bree's closet and reached under her nightgowns for the small Ruger 9mm she sometimes kept in her purse when we went out somewhere fancy. Ava reached for it, but I put it in my pocket along with a box of bullets. I'll see how you do along the way before I let you anywhere near it.
But Alex, she began.
Follow orders, I said. I picked up the bag and left the house with her trailing. Locking the door, I realized that if I was to have any hope of catching up with Mulch before he killed the rest of my family, I was going to have to divorce myself from what had already happened. I was going to have to compartmentalize, focus on the task, and deal with my grief later. I was going to have to act as if I were on a case where I had zero emotional involvement. We left with Ava driving and me riding shotgun with Janny's computer in my lap. I never looked back. I couldn't bear the thought of it. Ava was no polished driver, but she had grit and settled into the task with every bit of her little being.
Where are we going?
She asked again, after I'd seen she could follow basic directions and not hit oncoming cars. Get across the bridge, I replied. Head south until I tell you different. Soon we were on I-95, in the far right lane heading toward Richmond, Virginia. My mind no longer felt fried. It had a purpose, and began to click off the things I needed. Money, lots of it, and a new phone, and a new car. And I had to tell someone about Damon. Though I did not want to, I turned my phone back on. Rather than give in to my first impulse and dial Samson, I called Detective Tess Alia. It's Cross, I said when she answered.
Where the hell are you? Alia demanded. You need to be in a hospital. Everyone's looking for...
There's a male body in my backyard, I said. I believe it's my son, Damon. Ava almost went off the road.
My God, the detective gasped. Are you there now?
I don't think I'll ever go back there, detective, I said.
Where are you?
Mulch has us heading in the general direction of hell, I replied, before lowering the window and hurling my iPhone onto the highway while going 60 miles an hour.
Chapter 22. It was nearly dawn that Saturday morning after Easter. Tess Alia had been in Alex Cross's backyard since 11 the night before, overseeing her second crime scene in less than 24 hours. She'd welcomed the help from John Sampson and Ned Mahoney, allowing Cross's current partner to search the house and his former FBI partner to take charge of the gathering of evidence. From blood spatters, tire tracks, and marks in the dirt, they'd determined that the killer had brought the body into the alley behind the house and then dragged it through the gate into the backyard. Mahoney's men believed the tracks were made by a pickup truck with bald tires. They'd also discovered that, like Breeze, many of the boy's teeth had been pulled. Watching the corpse loaded into a body bag and wheeled out of the backyard, Aaliyah was thinking that, in one sense, the teeth pulling went along with the generalized mutilations of the bodies. But in another nagging sense, it didn't. The teeth removal and the clipped fingertips could be efforts to hide the victim's true identity. But the DNA would give it away eventually, so why desecrate the body? The detective understood, of course, that sometimes with the criminally insane, there was no specific reason for why they did what they did. But the almost uniform size of the oval cuts, combined with the regular pattern, made her believe that there was some sort of logic to it, twisted or otherwise. She made a note to herself to ask Mahoney to run the pattern and the oval cuts through the VICAP files to see if they had ever surfaced before. And then she followed the gurney bearing the corpse around the side of the house. As first light appeared in the sky, she saw that the media had descended on the scene. Captain Quintus was on the front porch, and she went to him. "Anything?" he asked. "Lots," Aaliyah said. "I just can't tell you if any of it's usable yet. You?" The homicide captain shook his head, looking drawn and exhausted. Mahoney joined them, said, "Quantico Computer Lab called me 10 minutes ago. The bugs Mulch put in the house, they were designed to transmit through Cross's wireless network, but where the feeds went is anyone's guess at this point." Sampson came out of the house holding his phone.
"Alex still isn't answering. He doesn't even have his phone on. We can't track him."
"Probably why he doesn't have it on," Mahoney said.
"He'll call in eventually, though, right?" Aaliyah asked.
"I don't know," Sampson replied. "Sounds to me like he's on a mission."
"Can I put out a bulletin on him?" Aaliyah asked. "Request that he be detained for questioning?"
"Questioning," Sampson said.
"For what?"
Aaliyah held up her hands.
"Just doing my job here, detective. I'd be asking the same thing of anybody who saw two murdered family members in the same day and then fled."
"We know Alex Cross a whole lot better than you do, Detective Aaliyah," Mahoney fired back. "He isn't fleeing. He's hunting."
"While suffering from a closed head injury?" she said calmly.
"We don't know that," Captain Quintus replied.
"Really?" she said. "You all certainly sounded sure of it last night."
Silence descended on the group for several seconds before Quintus said, "I won't put out a bulletin."
"But Captain,"
Aaliyah began.
"End of discussion, detective. I won't do it."
Chapter 23. They heard shouts from down the street. Several of the reporters and cameramen behind the barricade were having some kind of dispute.
"Another subject, sir?"
Aaliyah said, turning away.
"Go on," he replied.
"I think we need the media on our side," she replied. "We need to tell them about the kidnappings and about Mulch. Put his picture from the fake driver's license on television."
"Well, that could open up a whole other can of nightcrawlers,"
Sampson protested.
"My nickel opinion, the less they know, the better."
"I agree,"
Mahoney said.
"I don't," the homicide captain said. "Detective Aaliyah's right. We have to get them involved now. Someone somewhere could have seen Cross's kids, or his grandmother, or Mulch."
"Do you want me to talk to them?" Aaliyah asked.
"The reporters?"
My job, Detective, Quintus said. Go get some sleep, all of you. You're no good to Cross or his family if you can't think straight.
The homicide captain went down off the porch and out onto the street.
Sorry if I stepped on any toes or poked any sacred cows,
Aaliyah said to Samson and Mahoney.
Apology accepted, the FBI agent said wearily. We're a bit sensitive when it comes to Alex. He's one of a kind.
I know, she said. Alex Cross is one of the reasons I wanted to become a cop in the first place.
Aaliyah climbed off the porch then, thinking that what she'd said was true.
She'd read about Cross's exploits as a teenager and admired him almost as much as she admired her father. The detective cringed. Her dad, Bernie. She'd promised herself she'd go knock on his door this morning, but she was simply too exhausted to make the hour-long drive. Down on the sidewalk, Captain Quintus had an army of reporters surrounding him. Aaliyah went in the opposite direction, heading to her car. As she got in and pulled out into traffic, her thoughts kept returning to Cross's last words to her. Mulch has us heading in the general direction of hell.
Us? Who was with Cross?
Mulch has us heading in the general direction of hell. What did that mean? On the one hand, it could be a figure of speech. On the other, it could mean that Cross had communicated with the madman. Couldn't it? Or was that just a figment of her tired and frazzled imagination?
Chapter 24. Don't fret, Marcus, Acadia chided. You know Cross will call you for too long. I told him to call right back, and it's been hours, Sunday said coldly, looking straight ahead from the back seat of the Durango, watching out the windshield as Cochrane drove them along that muddy road in the forest toward Harrow's place. The rain had stopped. Dawn was coming on. He's got no choice, Acadia said. Cross will, I know he'll call, Sunday snapped at her. The question is, why is he waiting so long? What's his angle? What's he doing? Three birches coming up, Cochrane said, and slowed to a stop. Acadia handed Sunday another gym bag, said, You're sure it's smart to end this all so soon? We've made our point in Cross's mind, Sunday said. Time to take care of loose ends and move on. That's how this game works, right? We keep moving. We keep everything in motion. That way, Cross stays off balance, can't focus, can't even find a target. Acadia shrugged. Your game, your rules. Cochrane said, 15 minutes? Make it 20, Sunday said, and got out of the car. As the day brightened, he climbed down the bank, found that overgrown logging trail, and followed it again to the ledge above the clearing and Harrow's shack. Sunday saw wisps of smoke rolling lazily from the stovepipe and did not pause, continuing down the steep slope until he was at the edge of the yard. Right on cue, the door opened slightly and the Rottweiler came bounding out. He circled Sunday, who stood stone still, and let the dog wind him for a scent that might indicate a weapon. When the dog barked that he was clean, Sunday set off for the door, which opened wider. He climbed the stoop past the chainsaw and the gas can and closed the door quickly behind him, calling to Harrow. Your dog's taking a dump. Long as it ain't in here, Harrow said, sitting down at the table. You got the extra 100K? You get in and out clean? Asked Sunday, sitting down too, and noticing the mirror was there again. Wasn't in that alley more than a minute, tops, the skinhead said. You better have that extra we talked about. I've got it,